I'm Jim Falzerano, and this is the Guardian Weekly podcast for November 26th, 2008. This week...
At the moment, we're in the realm of prediction. We know that Obama promised during his election campaign to deal through dialogue and diplomacy with Iran. I mean, he hasn't taken the famous military option off the table, as George Bush always refused to do.
Can Iran's president survive without the great Satan?
The authorities have just thrown money at the problem, and yet there seems to be no upturn. The markets have been falling very rapidly. The banks have been imploding. And now we've got US car makers going bankrupt.
Is this just a recession or something much worse? And Darwin turns 200. With the price of oil falling dramatically and the prospect of a more moderate administration in Washington, how will Iran's theocratic government cope? Ian Black, The Guardian's Middle East editor, told me about the political problems facing Iran's hardline president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
You have a very interesting situation developing here where Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is almost certainly going to stand for re-election next summer. The timing, from his point of view, looks bad to appalling, really because of the deteriorating economic situation. Iran has been hit very badly by the very sharp fall in oil prices. 80% of Iran's earnings come from oil. He has spent a lot of money. He's very populist. He likes to buy things, to put money on the table, to keep people happy. And basically, he's spent the rainy day money at the moment that it's running out and the price has dropped very dramatically. He has a problem.
So presumably he didn't, when he was being liberal, he didn't assume, he couldn't have imagined that the price of oil would have fallen this low.
Well, interestingly, Ahmadinejad said a couple of things that have are not going to look good in retrospect. He said that oil wouldn't fall below $100 a barrel. And he also said some way the American people, the American system would find a way to prevent Barack Obama from becoming president. So on two important predictions, he's not got a very good record.
Well, let's talk about Barack Obama. Let's assume for the sake of argument, and it's not a big ask, that Barack Obama will be a more moderate president than George Bush. Now, the great Satan, the United States as perceived by Iran, has been a big political boon to Ahmadinejad. What's going to happen now if Barack Obama presents a very moderate and a very reasonable face to the international community?
Well, at the moment, we're in the realm of prediction. We know that Obama promised during his election campaign to deal through dialogue and diplomacy with Iran. I mean, he hasn't taken the famous military option off the table, as George Bush always refused to do. But Obama sounds more reasonable, sounds more open to discussion. The first thing that happened was that after a couple of days of silence from Tehran, several days after the election, Ahmadinejad sent a letter congratulating Obama on his election, which was in itself an extraordinary thing to do. For 30 years, there's been no such message from an Iranian president to a newly elected American one. So he was clearly trying to take the opportunity to strike a different tone. But having said that, Ahmadinejad then returned to some of the more familiar language of this very troubled discourse of talking about the need for a thorough review of policies and for America to be fair and just and not to support oppression and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, there was this exchange. Obama's response was not to dismiss it out of hand. In a knee-jerk way, he said he would have to study it, but he made some very pointed comments about how it was unacceptable for Iran to acquire nuclear weapons and to support terrorist groups, which are the two main strands of this very difficult relationship.
Now, you said that the timing was not very good for an election next summer for the for the Iranian president. What do you foresee as happening? If he's going to lose, to whom is he going to lose?
Well, the very big question in Iranian politics is who will challenge Ahmadinejad? Well, first of all, we're not certain that Ahmadinejad will himself stand. He's been said to be suffering from ill health and has slightly, you know, receded from the front row. But he's still functioning. And as far as we know, he is going to stand. He needs the approval of the man who really counts in Iranian politics, which is the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. This is still a theocracy where a senior clergyman sits at the very apex of the political system. Now, If Ahmadinejad stands, then he will have to be judged by his performance and by the particular problem that I mentioned earlier of this catastrophically deteriorating economic situation. The larger question, it seems, is will somebody else stand to try to steer politics in Iran in a different direction? And the smart money of the smart people I spoke to on my recent trip there was that the most likely outcome is that there will be a more moderate conservative figure is likely to stand, somebody who commands support from the same sort of areas, but without being seen as Ahmadinejad is in many ways to have gone too far, certainly in his mismanagement of the economy, and interestingly to a large extent in alienating international public opinion with his infamous comments on Israel, the Jews, and so on and so forth.
Now, for liberal-minded Iranians, secular-minded Iranians, the middle class, if we may use that phrase, what is the outlook for them? What is the prognosis? Are their views still relatively unheard? Do they have a future in Iranian politics?
What's very striking when you visit Iran, and I really spent time mostly in Tehran itself, is that in the northern suburbs of the city, this is a vast, sprawling city. The wealthier northern part of it is one world, and the center and the south are another. They're completely separate. You can be in North Tehran and you can see women all dressed in headscarves, certainly because they have to be, but wearing very elegant Western clothes under that, and the attitudes that you meet are more familiar and more Western. You go into the center and the south of the city, it has a completely different feel to it. You go to, as I did, to the famous Friday prayers at Tehran University. It's still a showcase of the revolutionary tradition, with a sermon by a leading mullah, a leading cleric, and the faithful shouting slogans, politics and religion intertwined. The middle classes are deeply disenchanted with the regime. They don't feel very represented because the reformists were essentially shut out of the last parliamentary elections. And a big question for them is, will there be a reformist candidate to challenge Ahmadinejad or some other conservative in the coming elections? And the answer is, we don't yet know. The former president, Khatami, who presided over a period of relative moderation and reform in recent Iranian history until he was beaten 3 years ago by Ahmadinejad, is under pressure to stand, but many people say he will not do so because he can't win. But there's a lot of speculation, there's a lot of talk about that. As I say, many of the people I spoke to who give a sense of understanding what's going on is that the likely outcome is that there will be a pragmatic conservative will emerge as a rival candidate.
According to a U.S. National Intelligence Council report, the year 2025 will mark the end of America's global dominance. I asked Julian Borger, The Guardian's diplomatic editor, if this is the end of the Bush Doctrine.
It's complicated. I mean, the Bush Doctrine in particular was the doctrine that anyone who harbors a terrorist group or a threat is also considered a threat. Now, that maybe has fallen by the wayside anyway, but the kind of broader Bush doctrine of the use of unilateral power, the formation of coalitions of the willing behind a kind of U.S. lead, the world doesn't look like that anymore.
Now, one of the other things the report talks about is the fact that international organizations like the U.N. are ill-equipped to deal with the problems that will arise. And in fact, the report used the word ramshackle to describe these. My question is, given the crises over resources that will inevitably arise, presumably this is going to be a problem. And I want you to focus on one crisis, the food crisis. It seems that a lot of countries are not leaving anything to chance, and they are buying up land in other countries so as to guarantee their own food supplies. Let's talk about the potential crises that could cause.
Well, there's a danger that there'll be a step back from the trade, world trade in food, and people and countries will focus on growing their own food, not only within their own borders, but in parts of other countries as well. That means that there'll be far more emphasis on protecting those areas that they control and protecting the sea lanes to make sure that they have security of food supply, and much less focus on guaranteeing that world trade functions smoothly. Now, that will mean that's bad news for countries that don't have that access to arable land, and also bad news in general in terms of world food prices.
So let's talk about some particular examples. South Korea getting involved in Madagascar, China looking for land in Laos, and Saudi Arabia investing in Brazil. What are the potential problems that come when one country buys land in another country specifically for food?
Well, there are issues involved of what happens to the people who were on that land in the first place. Now, there are few areas in the world where there's actually absolutely nobody there. It's completely virgin soil. So what happens to the local culture that's grown up on that land? Are they completely displaced? In which case, you're creating a conflict there. There's obviously issues of justice. Are you going to ring fence this land and put your own security forces there? How are you going to maintain this food security that you think you've bought? And what happens when there is a crunch, when there is a serious food shortage, and the host country decides, well, actually, we need that food. It's grown on our land. We want it. We don't care what the previous government or even we agreed to before. And then you have another source of conflict. So there are endless flashpoints here being sort of sowed like landmines in the road.
Sure. So the host government is caught between the needs of its own people and the contractual obligations that it's made to the other country.
Yeah, it does a deal for cash now because it needs the cash. But
sure,
further down the line, its own people may be starving and can see another country's nationals growing food next door and wants it.
So in a world where there is no one superpower, where rich countries are trying to buy land in other countries to have their food safety guaranteed, what happens when rich countries get into conflicts over their food supplies?
You can imagine a whole range of scenarios, and you can imagine guerrilla war. You can imagine serious conflicts, for example, among the emerging nations in the East. This is one of the predictions made in the NIC report, that there is a possibility that as these countries grow, and they're growing really fast, India and China is the example the NIC give, if it is a question of a rush for resources, a bit like it was in sort of mid to late 19th century, then the potential for conflict is very serious indeed.
This week, we're leading the print edition of The Weekly with Julian Borger's story about the rich world buying up the fields of the poor. Also in the print edition, we're looking back in time to another period of food stress, when the Mayan Empire went from boom to total collapse in little more than a century. Rory Carroll has been talking to some experts on the demise of this civilization. And in our books section, we review Manjit Kumar's Quantum. If you want to get to grips with the nature of reality, this is the book that you should read. Plus, we've got a special extended report for World AIDS Day. The Guardian's Sarah Bosley warns that although attention has shifted away, no one should believe that the HIV virus has been beaten. Last week, we spoke to Rory Carroll about the challenges facing Latin American leaders such as Hugo Chavez, now that George Bush is leaving the world stage. This week, Carroll spoke to John Dennis about how the Venezuelan president fared in national elections.
The opposition have made some key gains in urban areas, especially Caracas, and they've basically been able to claw back some political space that had almost evaporated over the last couple of years.
And yet, Hugo Chavez has hailed these results as a great victory for his party.
And in a sense, he is. I mean, both sides can legitimately claim some element of victory. Chavez has won 17 out of 22 states that were up for grabs, mostly in rural areas. And after 10 years in power, that's no small feat for any government. However, the opposition have won the most populous and the most economically important states. And especially in the heart of Caracas, what we've now seen is that increasingly in Venezuela, instead of an old kind of, you know, poor people supporting Chavez and rich people supporting the opposition, increasingly we're seeing an urban-rural divide, and it's city dwellers, including the poor city dwellers, and now increasingly fed up with the government and service delivery, especially over crime, inflation and just poor public services, whereas rural areas remain bastions of loyalty.
How will this election result affect Chavez's plans to extend the time an individual might serve as president?
Well, it's still not quite clear, because what was really the reason these elections mattered so much is that Chavez is hoping to use them as a springboard to change his constitution through a referendum to allow him to run again and to basically abolish presidential term limits. Now, with both sides claiming victory here today, it's not quite clear what's going to happen next. It's going to be a tussle now between Chavez and the opposition to take the initiative. And certainly Chavez has claimed that he has a mandate now to take things forward, to deepen his socialist revolution. But the opposition, meantime, now have a lot more to play for. They have now controlling Caracas and a lot of key municipalities and slums, which used to be loyal to Chavez. So basically it's going to be fascinating, and we don't know really whether Chavez will be able to build on this or not.
Here in the capitalist Europe, Rory, we're all gripped by the pre-budget report. But how is the credit crunch affecting Venezuela? Because the falling price of oil presumably might affect Chavez's political fortunes.
Yes, so far it hasn't, because the fall in oil prices has yet to filter through to the Venezuelan economy. But certainly next year what's going to happen is that the free spending ways of the Chavez government, and here they've basically tripled the state budget over the past few years, that is going to have to end, and Chavez will no longer be able to throw money at foreign allies as well as here. And for example, we just seen in this election a real free spending way whereby Chavista candidates were giving fridges, cookers, mattresses, beds, fans, and thousands of them away to people, and this is in the run-up to the vote. Now from next year onwards, I think that Chavez will have much more will find that much more difficult to do, just because there'll be far less money here because of the oil price tumble.
Rory Carroll. The Guardian's business editor, Deborah Hargreaves, worries that the current recession shows signs of becoming something much more malign. I asked her what troubled her about recent financial trends.
I think it does feel different, yes, and I'm quite worried about what's going on, actually. It does seem that things don't appear to be getting better, and particularly in the US, the authorities have just thrown money at the problem, and yet there seems to be no upturn. The markets have been falling very rapidly. The banks have been imploding. And now we've got US car makers going bankrupt. And I think this does feel like a different type of downturn. In the past, don't forget, we've had a financial crisis usually after a recession has got going. And that's because banks have been lending to companies who've subsequently gone bust. This time, the financial crisis has come first and banks have stopped lending, full stop. They're not lending to anyone. And that makes the crisis potentially a lot worse, because if companies can't get credit and loans, they can't survive.
So the normal cure for this sort of thing, lower interest rates, doesn't seem to be working. And my question is, can it work in the current climate?
Well, lower interest rates, of course, take a long time to feed through. And in the UK, we've really only just gone down to an interest rate that might get the economy going again after the Bank of England's 1.5-point cut. We've been a bit behind here. We haven't really moved quickly enough to reduce our interest rates. But this is a crisis that's not entirely affected by interest rates. The Bank of England and the Federal Reserve can cut their interest rates as much as they like. But if the banks themselves aren't lending to each other, and if the banks aren't lending to businesses or to consumers, then that any amount of interest rate cuts is going to make no difference. And that's what's happening at the moment. You've seen the government urging banks in the UK to lend more, particularly to small businesses. And yet they're not doing very much. In fact, they're calling in loans and they're forcing small businesses to go bust.
So is there a bind where the banks don't want to lend, although lending would presumably be the way out of the crisis? But if they lend, then they may be vulnerable to takeover or bankruptcy. So it seems to be almost a catch-22 for them.
Well, it is a bit. I mean, they're obviously wary of lending to each other because they don't know which one's going to go bust next. They're also wary of lending to businesses with anything other than very, very good credit records, and the same for individuals. Citigroup has to raise $100 billion by next March, so it doesn't have enough money itself. This is the situation they're worried about. They're worried that they might run short of cash, which is why they're hoarding all this cash.
It's a different kind of fear, isn't it? Normally, we have the consumers are the ones who are fearful, and that's what causes a recession. But here it's the banks who are fearful.
It's the banks who are very fearful and have been fearful for more than a year. The banks have passed that fear, if you like, onto their customers, the other businesses that they deal with and companies. And the companies are passing that fear onto us. And I think there is a danger of a vicious circle developing here, because we're seeing companies cut jobs in anticipation of a downturn. For example, last week, BT said it was cutting 10,000 jobs. Business was fine, but it was worried about what might happen in the future. And so if you get into that sort of cycle, you see we're talking ourselves into a worse downturn than we might have.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. One more question. The consumer. The consumer always drives our economic system. Is that a model that we can sustain? Forget about the environmental issue, but in terms of this, these kinds of problems, which are really unforeseen, is it possible we may have to question the consumer-driven economy?
Well, I think we do have to question that. And I think you need look no further than Japan for an example of an economy that imploded and couldn't get itself out of the recession and deflationary environment it was stuck in. And that was because consumers wouldn't spend. Once you get falling prices and the threat of deflation, consumers put off purchases until they think things will be cheaper. And so prices fall yet again, and companies cut wages, and the value of debt actually increases in a deflationary economy. And so in Japan, those consumers were so worried that they didn't spend any money. And I think that might happen here. You know, people are already very wary of losing their jobs, and that they're not spending as much as they should do. And then, of course, that has a knock-on effect on retailers who would then get into trouble.
Doesn't sound like a Merry Christmas then.
It's not. I don't think it is. Not for the high street, at least.
Deborah Hargreaves, thank you very much. He studied to be a clergyman and was a creationist before he came up with what philosopher Dan Dennett has called the most important single idea that anyone has ever had. London's Natural History Museum has just opened an exhibition marking the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin. Ian Sample, the Guardian science correspondent, has been for a visit.
It's wonderful when you walk in there, actually. It's this very sort of incredibly atmospheric, slightly dingy room, probably to keep the light levels down because of the fragility of some of the specimens. But they have some specimens that are brought back from the original HMS Beagle voyage of the 1930s. They have first editions of The Origin of Species. They have copies of his notebooks, his personal notebooks, and his private correspondence to scientists and colleagues, but also very private letters just to friends, and also, you know, to his soon-to-be wife. What I really liked about it, what's striking, is they have examples down there which you can look at, and you can see the differences between species and between animals that first sowed those seeds of interest about whether there is something going on here, whether maybe species aren't all plonked here as they look now. They were different in the past.
You mention a man who had to synthesize a tremendous amount of evidence, and that's really probably more than anything else what the exhibit shows us. Why did it take him so long to actually publish his book?
He was an incredibly cautious and thorough man. Put aside for a moment the enormous issue of the implications of what he was saying. He was the first person to come out and say species are not fixed, that they move from one thing to another. Extraordinary thing to say at that time. But he had to synthesize an enormous amount of information, as you said. Not only did he have to know that there was a lot of variation within a species, he had to know that whenever a species reproduces, that not all of those young will reproduce themselves. There has to be some kind of selection. Some of them have to fall by the wayside. So there's competition. That is an element of there is a survival of the fittest. And another thing that was up against him was that he had to show that the world was old enough for any of this to actually happen. Evolution takes place at an extraordinarily slow rate. And the best geologists at the time thought that the world was, what, 10, 20 million years old. Evolution takes far longer than this. And he had just, what he was up against was extraordinary. So he wanted almost to have this completely nailed down and absolutely finalized in his head. When he went to Down House, he did 8 years of research just on barnacles to try and look at more issues of variation. He really wanted to just prove it to death almost. You can't do that. And in the end, it was probably, you know, being prompted by Alfred Wallace's letter that rushed him into print.
Sure. Now, you did talk about the implications. Not only did he know that this would very seriously affect his wife, but also the intellectuals at the time, his fellow Victorians, he knew what a tremendous amount of a trouble this would cause, and yet he still felt he had to go on with this.
Yeah, and I think he, a sense you get from the information that is down at the Natural History Museum is here was a man who was facing being scooped after sitting on this idea for 20, 30 years, and he had worked, toiled away at this for decades, and to then get a letter from someone like Wallace saying, you know, I think something like this might be going on, to then, you know, that kind of forces your hand. The great thing is, although he was cautious about it, although he was reluctant to publish this, he believed it. That was the thing that he just always had to come back to, even when, said his one of his main mentors and friends at Cambridge, a geologist, was incredibly disappointed when he read the paper, when he read The Origin of the Species. Darwin wrote back and just said, look, this is I've looked at this for decades. This is how it is.
And he went forward even though he knew it wasn't really in his self-interest personally.
Yeah, and he knew that it was, you know, this must be incredibly difficult. It was upsetting to him, although he had to deal with the evidence and take the evidence at face value. And you know, hats off to him for doing that. It was devastating for his wife and devastating for a lot of those people incredibly close to him because he was from such a religious background.
Sure. Darwin at the Natural History Museum. Ian Sample, thank you very much. That's all for this week. This podcast was produced by Ben Green. I'm Jim Falzerano. See you next time.